Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Iraqi Kurdish President Masoud Barzani declared Friday that Kurdish fighters have seized Sinjar from the Islamic State militants who had controlled the Iraqi town for more than a year. Barzani spoke to reporters as Kurdish forces raised their flag in the town center. The jihadists had killed and enslaved thousands of the minority Zaydi community at Sinjar as the insurgents swept across Iraq in August 2014. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Tunisia took a more cautious stance, saying he was absolutely confident that Sinjar would be freed over the next days by the Kurdish Peshmerga forces supported by U.S. airstrikers and ground spotters. Speaking at the White House earlier, President Barack Obama said he believes the Islamic State advance in Iraq and Syria has been contained but not destroyed. The U.S. military says it is reasonably certain that it killed Jihadi John, the notorious British Islamic State militant who appeared in videos depicting the murder of Western hostages in an airstrike in Syria. Army Colonel Steve Warren, a spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition fighting the Islamic State group, said officials believe a drone strike on a car late Thursday hit its intended target and that two people were killed. He said final verification is needed to determine if the people killed were Jihadi John and the driver. Liberia has welcomed the lifting of U.S. sanctions that were imposed on the country in 2004 by then-President George W. Bush. Look at our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Secretary of State John Kerry says the eyes of the world are on Tunisia, and America wants the country considered to be the birthplace of the Arab Spring to succeed. He commented in Tunisia on the first leg of a three-nation tour that will focus heavily on political and security instability in Syria. Kerry said the United States had provided Tunisia with more than $700 million in assistance in 2011 and committed to initial plans on Friday to provide a new loan guarantee. Myanmar's National League for Democracy Party of Aung San Suu Kyi has captured a majority of seats in parliament, surpassing the government and military-backed parties. Myanmar's Election Commission announced the victory Friday, saying the NLD has just over 80% of the votes tallied. VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman describes what the NLD will do next.
Well, according to party officials, what its leader Aung San Suu Kyi wants to do next is to have a meeting of what they're calling national reconciliation with President Thein Sein and the army chief. And all indications are that meeting will happen and will probably be held next week.
The Constitution prohibits Aung San Suu Kyi from becoming president because her late husband and sons are British. U.S. defense officials say two B-52 bombers flew near contested islands in the South China Sea earlier this week and got a verbal warning from the Chinese while in flight. Peter Cook is a U.S. Pentagon spokesman.
I know that we conduct B-52 flights in international airspace in that part of the world all the time. And my understanding is there was one B-52 flight, and I'm not even sure the date on it, there was an effort made by Chinese ground controllers to reach out to that aircraft, and that aircraft continued its mission unabated. Nothing changed.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman on Friday said Beijing opposes the action of undermining China's sovereignty and security under the pretext of freedom of navigation and overflight. Russia's state aviation agency has banned Egypt's national carrier from flying to Russia. Amid speculation, a bomb was planted on the Russian airliner that crashed last month in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Airport officials said the news agency notified Domodedovo Airport in Moscow, where Egypt's flights arrive, that the ban is effective on Saturday. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
As the European winter approaches, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees reports additional reception sites in Greece are urgently needed to accommodate the massive flow of refugees and migrants from Syria and other countries of conflict.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, the International Organization for Migration says it welcomes a new agreement on a roadmap to manage African migration to Europe. And the French news agency says the Nigerian military has freed 61 hostages held in a Boko Haram camp in the northeastern state of Borno. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the French news agency says the Nigerian military has freed 61 hostages held in a Boko Haram camp in the northeastern state of Borno. The army spokesman says four Boko Haram militants were killed and another captured in the raid. He says most of the hostages were women and children. Hundreds of civilians abducted by Boko Haram have been rescued by military units. However, none has been identified as one of the hundreds of schoolgirls abducted more than a year ago in Chibok. The U.S. military says it has carried out an airstrike targeting Jihadi John. He is the notorious British Islamic State militant who appeared in several videos depicting the gruesome murder of Western hostages. Officials say it is not immediately clear whether the militant, identified by Western intelligence agencies as Mohammed Mwazi, was killed in yesterday's drone strike on the Islamic State's de facto capital of Raqqa, Syria. Speaking on condition of anonymity, senior U.S. officials described the strike as a clean hit on the vehicle in which Mwazi was riding, adding it's likely that the militant was killed. British Prime Minister David Cameron also said today he cannot confirm Mwazi's death, but nonetheless thanked the U.S. for its efforts in carrying out the attack. The Kuwaiti-born Mwazi, who has British citizenship, has been one of the top targets of Western intelligence agencies since he appeared in videos depicting the beheadings and other killings of Western hostages. As the European winter approaches, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees reports additional reception sites in Greece are urgently needed to accommodate the massive flow of refugees and migrants from Syria and other countries of conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is increasing support efforts on the Greek island of Lesbos, where the need is greatest. It says nearly half of the 660,000 refugees and migrants who have arrived in Greece this year have landed on Lesbos. Despite the deteriorating weather conditions, the agency says an average of 5,000 people a day are arriving in Greece, and this is causing great problems. It says accommodations are overstretched and inadequate to handle so many people. Diane Goodman is the Director of Operations for the UNHCR's European Bureau. Speaking by telephone from Athens, she says there only are 2,800 places for some 12,000 refugees and migrants currently on the island.
What we're trying to do together with partners is to identify really those that are most vulnerable because there is limited accommodation that we try to make sure that the people with the greatest need get it. We're also distributing blankets and winter clothes, working with the volunteers as well who are providing some hot meals. So we're doing what we can in the circumstances, but we really hope that the reception capacity will be increased.
The UNHCR is the only UN agency on Lesbos. Goodman says the agency is working around the clock with volunteers and non-governmental organizations and hopes soon to boost its current staff of 29 to 40. Despite the many challenges facing aid workers, she says it is important to realize that lives nonetheless are being saved and essential needs are being met. Goodman says the government has not yet allocated land to establish reception sites that would measure up to the standards needed to accommodate, register, and screen the refugees. She notes, however, that the UNHCR and Greek authorities currently are on an assessment mission to come up with an appropriate reception plan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is receiving increased criticism from her own Conservative Party. The criticism is over her liberal policies of accepting large numbers of migrants in Europe's demographic crisis. Germany's finance minister demands that Ms. Merkel tell Syria that more refugees should not come to Germany. Meanwhile, Austria has put on hold recent plans to build a fence to control migrant entries from Slovenia. The International Organization for Migration says it welcomes a new agreement on a roadmap to manage African migration to Europe. The roadmap was hammered out today, summit this week on a Malta, in Malta, by European Union and African countries. It includes a trust fund that could help African migrants return home or provide development aid to boost local economies. Leonard Doyle is spokesman for the International Organization for Migration. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the plan for African migrants.
Well, we're really pleased by it. We think that it kind of brings some really interesting clarity, and it's the first intercontinental agreement on managing migrant flows from Africa to Europe. So that's kind of an extraordinary thing. You had about 60 heads of state, some tense negotiations, but nothing untoward, and they came up with what we're calling a roadmap to manage the future migration flows.
What are some of the highlights?
Well, the important thing is they're talking about addressing the root causes. So by that, they mean like tackling everything from war, from poverty, from governance issues, etc. They're recognizing, I think, that migrants are coming because there's an arc of war from Africa all the way to Asia. It's bringing insecurity, causing poverty. And, of course, the impact of climate change is part of the picture. And we're coming up to the Paris Conference on climate change, and that shouldn't be forgotten. So the summit has really said, like, we've got to really start working across the board on migration. We can't simply be just putting up fences in Europe. We've got to help the African countries in particular.
How will this trust fund, this EU trust fund for Africa, work?
Well, if it's managed well and if it's funded properly, it should be able to give funding to African countries to create, you know, a good business environment so that their people feel that they have a chance by staying home to make a decent living for themselves and their communities instead of getting on the bus to go north. The Europeans are recognizing that the Africans need help to grow their economy, have stable governments, have rule of law, all that kind of thing.
Well, as you know, smuggling is a big business and much of it happens in Libya. Were there any provisions to deal with that?
There was a lot of talk about cracking down on crime, on smuggling, on trafficking. We've yet to see any kind of concrete action, but the Europeans are getting their act together there and they have a whole flotilla operating out of the Mediterranean. And those guys are focusing quite hard on the smuggling piece of it. But frankly, unless you get some nation building going on in Libya, it's mostly talk. So until the Libyans are helped to get their country together and get some rule of law going, the migrants are going to keep coming.
Now, the IOM says the summit expressed deep concern at the suffering, abuse, and exploitation suffered by women and children and the unacceptable loss of life in the desert or at sea. Is anything in particular being done to help women and children?
Well, I think the fact that it's in the declaration is important. There's a recognition, I think, now that you cannot have business as usual. You have to look after vulnerable people, women, children, people of minorities, people of different beliefs. And I think it's just a recognition that when there is a crisis, it's the most vulnerable who suffer most.
Now, it's a roadmap. This is not codified in law. So how will it be implemented and when will it be implemented?
I think when the trust fund gets going and they start getting some projects rolling, it'll be implemented very quickly. But behind the scenes, what the Europeans are most interested in is finding a way to get rid of people who've come in illegally, if you like, without a real chance of getting refugee status. So they're seeking to get returns, as they call them, what we might call deportations. And the Africans are saying, well, we don't want deportations, do it voluntarily or not at all. Behind the scenes, they're really saying, if you're going to get rid of people and deport them, you better send them back with some financial support, either for them as individuals or for the governments and communities that they're going back to.
But what are the odds of people, once they're in Europe, to voluntarily return home?
You say that as if you don't believe that people would voluntarily leave Europe, but I can assure you that a lot of people who come here don't like it. They find it cold, they find the people not necessarily welcome, they face discrimination, they feel, and they're living on the black market. So after not too long a time, you know, living under a bridge somewhere, you might be actually hankering after your family and support, even in a very poor community back home. And you recognize that the dream you set out with isn't quite matching the reality of the harsh world of an industrial north. So in that sense, people are quite willing to volunteer quite often, especially if they're given some dignity, if they're taken back by plane and they're allowed to come back without a black mark in their passport, and indeed they have some support maybe to set up a small business. We have some interesting case studies of this. If you look at iamamigrant.org, you'll see some interesting cases of people who've returned to Ghana with IOM's help, and one of them is now running a taxi business. Another chap is starting a yam business. So I think the truth is that when people leave Africa in particular, these are the entrepreneurial ones. These are the ones who have to get up and go. That's why they're leaving. They're not the poorest of the poor. By the time they've reached Europe, they've learned a lot. They've certainly learned how to use a smartphone and how to operate in a modern economy. So when they go back, if they're given some help, they can probably make a huge difference.
Leonard Doyle, spokesman for the International Organization for Migration from Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. The U.S. envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region is urging a restart of talks with no preconditions to end Burundi's violent political crisis. Tom Perriello is in Kampala to meet with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Mr. Museveni was chosen by regional leaders to mediate an end to the crisis. Violence erupted last April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term, which the political opposition said was unconstitutional. The president said Parliament elected him for his first term and not voters, so his action was legal. At least 240 people have been killed since April, and close to 300,000 people have been displaced. Meanwhile, the French press agency says Burundi's government and opposition welcomed a UN resolution passed yesterday afternoon. It called for urgent talks between all parties and approved the potential use of UN peacekeepers or troops from the African Union to prevent the country from erupting in violence. Opposition spokesman Jeremiah Minani said it was the first resolution that recognizes the seriousness of the crisis facing the country. The resolution has been greeted with approval by many civil society groups and human rights monitors. Sarah Jackson is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Africa in Nairobi. She spoke to reporter William Eagle about the Security Council move.
Well, as Amnesty International, we think that the Security Council resolution marks a significant step up in international engagement in Burundi and bolstering of support for regional actors that are pushing for mediation between the Burundian government and opposition parties. So we think it's a step in the right direction, and we hope that this will increase the likelihood of the mediation restarting in earnest.
Are you confident that inter-party talks will begin? Because in the past, President Nkurunziza has seemed reluctant to begin such talks, and I believe that he has said that he would not talk with one element of the opposition, that led by Leonard Nyangoma, the chairman of CNARED.
Well, the situation is such at the moment that mediation is absolutely essential to resolve this human rights crisis. The leadership is due to take place under the leadership of President Museveni. We understand that there are discussions ongoing to increase the involvement of the African Union as well in the mediation, and we hope that President Nkurunziza and other parties will see the importance of this at this critical time as the situation in Burundi really threatens to spiral out of control.
Also, the resolution says that UN peacekeepers or AU troops could also be used. Do you think that threat of potentially using peacekeepers or troops would add impetus or momentum to the call for talks?
Well, this is a political problem in Burundi that requires a political solution. We think that mediation is the way to move that forward, and we're not currently calling for any kind of armed intervention or peacekeeping in the current situation. At the same time, we understand that the African Union is beginning contingency planning for if the situation worsens. And in their resolution in October, they were looking into having the East African Standby Force ready in case that was needed.
The UN resolution requested that the Secretary General of the UN present options to the Security Council within 15 days on the future presence of the United Nations in Burundi to help end the crisis. Does Amnesty or any other organization with which you work, any civil society groups, have any ideas on how those UN forces might be used, those options?
Well, I would imagine at this stage that a range of options would be under discussion. There was previously a UN mission in Burundi. That UN mission, including the human rights monitors, was vastly scaled down in the lead-up to the elections and a temporary electoral mission put in place alongside the High Commission for Human Rights. So in addition to other options on the table, we would hope that they may be looking at scaling up the number of human rights monitors in Burundi in addition to those of the African Union. It's just so critical at the moment to have increasing eyes and ears on the ground to bear witness to what is happening and to act as a deterrent for a further escalation in the situation.
From Nairobi, that was Sarah Jackson of Amnesty International. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle. The Central African Republic's military, political, and religious leaders are assuring Pope Francis that his planned visit will be safe. That assurance comes after the Vatican expressed concern for the Pope's safety. The Minister of Public Security says security plans are in place despite recent violence in the capital, Bangui. A UN official says another 850 security personnel may be available in time for the Pope's scheduled November 30th visit. A law banning the controversial activity of trophy hunting continues to gain support in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The Animal Welfare and Wildlife Conservation Organization, Born Free USA, appeared at a hearing this week before the state Senate. The group testified in support of a bill to ban the possession, transport, import, export, processing, sale, or shipment of many of Africa's endangered species. Adam M. Roberts testified at the hearing. He is CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He says New Jersey has an opportunity to be a leader on this issue. He says the illegal trafficking of wildlife products is directly responsible for shocking declines in wildlife populations in recent years. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the legislation to ban trophy hunting.
This week in New Jersey, there was a hearing concerning legislation to prohibit the importation into the state of some trophies, wildlife trophies, of some of the most endangered animals on the planet, including elephants and rhinos and big cats. And the legislation that was introduced by Senator Lesniak of New Jersey is intended to try and stop this sort of grotesque killing of wildlife overseas and the importation of trophies for sport. I think what we're finding more and more across the country is that not only is the federal government taking action to try and address this conservation and animal welfare issue, but individual states are doing so as well, and obviously that's something that Born Free applauds.
How will this bill be enforced?
The bill will be enforced at the state level, and basically if the bill is approved, and of course Born Free hopes it will be approved, and approved expeditiously, it will prevent trophy hunters from going overseas and killing any of these protected species, mostly the big five that I've mentioned previously, and importing them back into the state of New Jersey. And for some of these animals, it's very hard to import them already because they are protected under the international treaty known as the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. One has to get a permit for some of these species to come back into the country. But of course, if they can't come into New Jersey at all, then that's going to prevent them from being killed in the first place. And I'll just add, the reason why I say that I hope that this bill will be passed expeditiously is because we're starting to see evidence more and more of trophy hunters going overseas and trying to kill these species like lions as fast as they can under the fear that the animal is going to be protected under the Endangered Species Act, and then that opportunity may soon be lost.
These pro-hunting groups argue that trophy hunting brings conservation funding into countries through fees for hunting permits. So how much money are countries actually making through these hunting permits?
it's a common ploy of the trophy hunting industry to suggest that somehow engaging in this slaughter en masse across Africa or anywhere in the world is going to generate revenue for local economies. Born Free's research shows that not only is it not generating revenue, in fact, only 1.8% of tourism revenue in Africa actually comes from trophy hunting revenue. Most of it, more than 98%, is coming from other forms of tourism, ecotourism, driving through the South African wine country, etc. So really, that's just a complete ploy, a PR stunt by the industry. But moreover, even that 1.8%, the money that does actually get generated from trophy hunting revenue, is not necessarily trickling down to the local communities. Many of these hunting operations are foreign-owned, and so the money is kept overseas, and the other folks on the ground are actually not seeing the financial and economic benefits. So we advocate strongly for ecotourism and non-consumptive wildlife tourism as ways to protect wildlife for future generations, but also to support the local economies of the people who live near with that wildlife.
You pointed out that New Jersey has the opportunity to be a leader on the issue of banning trophy hunting. Do you see other states taking up this issue as well?
What we've seen recently is that states all across the country are starting to take up the charge of looking at this issue. We just had a ballot initiative pass in Washington State that would prohibit the commercialization of a number of species, not just elephants for their ivory or rhinos for their horn, but also cheetah, pangolins, which are killed in the tens of thousands across the globe each year for their scales and their meat. So we're starting to see that happen all across the country now. And New York and New Jersey have done great work in terms of stopping the ivory trade. And as a result, California followed suit. So I think more and more we see that there's a groundswell of public support across the country for this kind of action. And if it's hard to do at the federal level, at least we can try at the state level, where the citizens of these individual states care so deeply about protecting wildlife.
What is the next step in getting this bill passed?
Well, I think as a result of the hearing, there will be some amendments made to try and clarify some specific aspects of the bill. And then once that happens, it'll go back to the Senate for a vote, and then we'll hopefully get it through the legislature before the year is up, or at least early into the new year.
That was Adam Roberts, CEO of Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Washington, D.C. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you hunt, handle, or eat bushmeat, you must take caution. I'm Dr. Conde Greaves. Certain animals, such as bats, monkeys, chimpanzees, and gorillas, carry the Ebola virus. Ebola is not the white man's disease. It was not brought here by humanitarian workers. The virus was first discovered in 1976 and named after the Ebola River in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Researchers believe fruit bats may be the natural carrier of the virus. It is believed the virus was passed to humans through handling and eating bush meat. Bush hunters face real dangers. A simple scratch, cut, or bite from a sick animal could pass the virus onto you. Preparing meat from a sick animal could also infect you. As long as Ebola is present, you must stay away from bush animals. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Chetan Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The U.S. military says it has carried out an airstrike targeting Jihadi John, the notorious British Islamic State militant who appeared in several videos depicting the gruesome murder of Western hostages. And the French news agency says the Nigerian military has freed 61 hostages held in a Boko Haram camp in the northeastern state of Borno. Coming up, music from Cameroon. And in our feature segment, a possible spike in Boko Haram attacks in Cameroon. I'm Yehisu Uhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports, with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Yehias.
Sonny, I understand African football fans have reason to cheer this weekend.
Yehias, it's a big weekend in African football as teams across the continent continue their quest to qualify for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, these are home and away series between the teams. The winner of each series, determined by goal aggregate, advances to the final round of African qualifying, which will feature 20 teams. Those 20 teams will be divided into five groups of four each, and the team that tops each of the five groups will book a much-coveted ticket to Russia 2018. Some qualifying results from Friday, and in maybe the biggest surprise so far, the Comoros Islands held visiting Ghana to a goalless draw. Our African football guru David Legg has been talking about the FIFA rankings in his analysis this week. Well, ponder this, VOA football fans. Ghana is 147 places above the Comoros Islands in the November FIFA rankings. Ghana is 30th, and Comoros is at number 177. So that has to be a big morale booster for the Indian Ocean Island Nation. Kudos to the Comoros Islands. Meanwhile, fans of the Harambee Stars of Kenya also had reason to cheer on Friday. The Kenyans beat the visiting Cape Verde Islands 1-0 in Nairobi on a goal by Michael Olunga in the ninth minute. In another 2018 World Cup qualifier, Libya defeated Rwanda by that same 1-0 scoreline. Because of the uncertain security situation in Libya, this match was played in Sousse, Tunisia. Faisal Saleh scored for the Libyans off a penalty shot early in the second half. In Antananarivo Friday, host Madagascar almost, and I stress almost, pulled off a big upset, but the Islanders ended up drawing with Senegal 2-2. Madagascar led 2-0 in the second half, but the Senegalese rallied on goals by Moussa Konaté and Sadio Mane in the 71st and 81st minutes. Well, my Ugandan colleague, Douglas Mpuga, had a big smile on his face when he danced into the office this morning. That's because the Cranes of Uganda scored a big 1-0 victory over host Togo Thursday in another World Cup qualifier. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, has more details for us, as well as other football news.
Farouk Mia's 39th-minute strike ensured Uganda pipped their host Togo by a solitary goal in their second-round Africa 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Lome on Thursday. The Democratic Republic of Congo edged Burundi 3-2 in Bujumbura. Guinea pipped hosts Namibia 1-0 in Windhoek. Benin edged Burkina Faso 2-1 in Cotonou. And Morocco outplayed Equatorial Guinea 2-0 in Agadir. In Switzerland, five of the seven candidates were declared eligible to contest the FIFA presidential elections due on the 26th of February next year, FIFA's ad hoc electoral committee disclosed in Zurich on Thursday they are Jordan's Prince Ali Al Hussein, Bahrain's Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa, Frenchman Jerome Champagne, Swiss-born Italian Gianni Infantino, and South African Tokyo Sekwale. Suspended FIFA Vice President Michel Platini and Liberia Football Association President Musa Hassan Bility have the right to appeal their case at the Court of Arbitration in Sports. VOA. Finally, the draws for the 2016 African Nations Championships takes place in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday. Teams who qualified to join hosts Rwanda for the contest are Angola, Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Gabon, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Lesotho, Mali, Morocco, Nigeria, Tunisia, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. I'm Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Because this is Africa. Zami, zami, na, eh, eh. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. Zamina mina, waka waka, zamina mina sakalewa. This time for Africa.
In another African qualifying result for the 2018 World Cup on Friday, South Africa travels to Angola and beats the Angolans 3-1 in Benguela. Final from Benguela, South Africa 3, Angola 1. Busy, busy World Cup weekend in African athletics. One of our big stories this week was Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge and Ethiopia's Mare Dibaba being named the male and female winners of the Ames Best Marathon Runner Award for 2015. The prizes were handed out at a gala in Athens, Greece. AIMS stands for Association of International Marathons and Distance Races. 26-year-old Mare Dibaba won the women's marathon at this year's World Championships in Beijing, China. She also won another marathon in China to begin the year and finished a close second at the Boston Marathon. For his part, 31-year-old Eliud Kipchoge won two major marathons in 2015, the London Marathon in April and the Berlin Marathon in September. In Berlin, Eliud clocked 2 hours and 4 minutes even, a personal best. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Kipchoge in Athens after he received his big Ames Award. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, let's listen in again to Andy's chat with Eliud. Here's Andy.
We are backstage at the Ames Best Marathon Runner of the Year Award 2015, and the man who's won that title, well, the men's title anyway, is Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya. Eliud, you talked in your speech, I thought, very interestingly and movingly about the importance of thanking people. You said you wanted to thank people over the 15 years of your international career. We all know about your coach, Patrick Sang, has been so important, but there are lots of others, you feel. I mean, a lot of people have gone into your success, not just this year, but in recent years.
Yes, actually, I want to thank sincerely to all those who have been side by side for me for the last 13 years, especially my coach, management, also the members of the press who have been actually airing my name in a high profile in the whole world, and the organization. Actually, this is a very good and very high trophy for me.
For the 19-odd percent of us who run but have nothing like special talent, I've often wondered, was there a point when you realised you had special ability for running? A realisation that you could be among the best?
Actually, when I was really running like any other kid when I was in school. But after school, then I tried to train, and I was really motivated by one of our runners, who is now my coach, Patrick Sang. And I decided to take this thing as professional and also love for the sport.
When you see others, the ones who aren't as gifted as you, outside the international sphere, can you relate to them when you see people running mass marathons and someone's out on the road for 4 hours? I mean, do you think, why do they do it? Or can you feel that their pain?
When I see some people running four hours, 5 hours, 6 hours to finish the marathon, I actually feel the perseverance. I actually feel the patience they have in training. I actually feel that pain that they are going through when running for all those eight hours. But all in all, I sum by saying that sport actually is healthy. Above all, it's healthy. And you know, when you are healthy, then you are well.
I'm looking down at the fine Ames trophy you've got here for the Marathon Runner of the Year. You must obviously have quite a few medals at home. Are you somebody who has a room where you put all those medals on display, or do you just stick them in a box somewhere?
No, I have. In my sitting room, I have a place to put all the medals, all the trophies. And also this one I will put in a very important place, because for the last 13 years, I have never been awarded and being honored with any trophy. This is my first time. That's why I'm saying sport is really a journey. And today I've realized that journey by being awarded by Hames.
Well, one final question. Maybe there's another medal, perhaps a gold one, next year, Rio Olympic Marathon. That would obviously be the ultimate. That's the target for you now?
Yeah, that's it. My target is Rio next year. I really want to hang that gold medal in my neck. That's the only thing. I have now Hames. I have the medals from World Championships, but I don't have a gold from Olympic Games.
Eliud Kipchoge, the Ames Best Marathon Runner male of 2015. Wish you every success for that quest for Olympic marathon gold. Thank you very much, Eliud.
Thank you.
Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this, it's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Finally, follow the sunny side of sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sunny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a possible spike in Boko Haram attacks in Cameroon. And next, religious violence in the rise in Africa. But first, some music. Here is Deba Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher Higher.
Priceless,
put yourself upon its throne. Hey, yeah, yeah. 20 years of power.
What?
30 plus and 14 more.
30 plus and 14 more.
All the worries that my family and my friends, their family.
In
a diamond and gold,
precious metals, or they bribe and line your pockets with our cash.
In a ride,
Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher, Higher. It is dry season in the far north of Cameroon, and that means the arrival of 35-plus degree heat and swarms of giant black flies. On the list of seasonal worries this year, residents in the region are adding a possible spike in Boko Haram attacks. Eugene Nforingwa reports from Maroua.
Swaths of northern Cameroon are covered by only scanty bushes all year round. In the dry season, nearly all the vegetation and rivers simply disappear, leaving a flat sandy terrain. As visitors know, you can point a vehicle or motorcycle in any direction and start racing. For years, this was the beauty of the region. Residents mapped shorter routes to their destination, and tourists easily reached wild game. But as a Lamido or local chief, Aliou Mamadou, says, things have changed dramatically in the past 3 years.
Le passage, surtout aujourd'hui avec l'arrêt des pluies.
The departure of the rains, he says, means the terrain is practicable almost everywhere outlaws like Boko Haram choose to go.
Les malfaiteurs, comme les Boko Haram peuvent aller.
Amadou's kingdom is a roadside collection of villages that sit on the Chadian border, southeast of the regional capital, Marwa. Most of the people there are sorghum farmers, headsmen, and micro-business owners who are mandated by tradition to welcome strangers. With the Nigerian border more than 150 kilometers away, this part of the far north is not considered risky territory. Yet, soldiers have raised checkpoints on the highway, while the population has created self-defense groups to keep watch.
Il est préoccupant, ça, je le vous assure. Nous ne dormons pas.
Amadou says the security situation is so worrying that inhabitants of his village are not sleeping.
Toute présence suspecte.
When the neighbor's house is burning, he says, you start pouring water on yours.
Quand la maison brûle, commencez à mouiller la maison, votre la case d'à côté, nous aussi.
The main fear that runs deep across the region is that suicide bombers can still sneak into crowded places and detonate bombs. In spite of high military presence, Boko Haram has successfully carried out more than a dozen deadly attacks this year. Two of them killed at least 34 people in Marwa, the main city once considered the safest place in the far north. With rivers drying up and bushes disappearing during the dry season, a driver called Yauba says terrorists can roam deeper hinterlands. Yauba says someone can leave Marwa and go as far as Kusiri without using any of the main roads. When it is wet and rivers are flowing, they will be forced to use bridges. But he says that is not the case in the dry season. A military official confirmed such fears as legitimate but would not comment on record. In the meantime, the government, private organizations and individuals are stepping up security. Banks, schools and even restaurants have cordoned their facilities with white and red tape and hired security guards to filter visitors. Last month, the United Nations started building a second concrete fence around its multi-agency compound in Marwa. The Rapid Response Battalion, the military unit at the forefront of the fight against Boko Haram, now has a deep trench running around its command base in Salak. And anyone traveling by air must go through a military checkpoint outside the Marwa International Airport. In remote corners like the village of Gidikis, communities have organized themselves to spot potential terrorists.
Dénoncer toute présence suspecte.
Amadou says he has asked members of his population to keep watch over markets and denounce any suspicious behavior or activity.
Nous surveillons les marchés avec nos veilleurs de nuit, le comité de.
At this time of the year, the Far North should be welcoming tourists. Instead, the region is bracing for Boko Haram's next strike. Eugene Fongwa, reporting for VOA Africa in Marwa, Cameroon.
Religious excuses for incidents of violence have been on the rise in Africa. At a recent meeting in Nairobi, experts examined ways of challenging the rising levels of radicalization among youth. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
Participants from Nigeria, Cameroon, and Kenya explored the local contexts of religious violence and examined the potential responses of African governments and security agencies. Speakers compared violent groups in northeast Nigeria, north Cameroon, and the coastal and northeast region of Kenya and cited various common factors that explore the problem. Ms. Fatma Chari Mohammed, a security expert from Nigeria, was among the key speakers at the forum.
It's about addressing the fundamental issues. The fundamental issues being the socioeconomic issues, the governance issues, corruption, weak states, holding our leadership accountable, the issue of impunity, the lack of understanding of the core issues where ideology is concerned.
Mohammed, a senior expert with a leading West African conflict and security consulting firm based in Nigeria, is now focusing our attention on the crisis in northern Nigeria.
There seems to be a lot of misconception and a lot of misunderstanding between the two major religions in this country. Where Nigeria is concerned, we've kind of depassed that stage to a certain extent because people now understand that terrorism is not necessarily about religious ideology. It's more about political ideology and looking for alternatives. Alternatives for livelihoods, alternatives for a different kind of life, the greed and need for power.
Among those alternatives for livelihoods, said the forum participants, are solutions to youth unemployment and lack of participation in local and national politics. Father Wilbert Lago, assistant bishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Mombasa, said religious leaders in collaboration with state organs and local communities were involved in finding solutions to the problem. He said one way was trying to ensure that the voices of the youth were heard. While this is not new for countries like Nigeria, Cameroon, and to some extent Kenya, it is a relatively novel phenomenon in the continent. Ms. Hawa Noor, a researcher at the Nairobi-based Institute of Security Studies, says there is a challenge in finding a clear definition of the words radicalization and terrorism.
From radicalization, who is a radical, who is an extremist, to the term terrorism, which does not have a scientific definition so far. So I think that is where the dilemma starts. And then it boils down to, you know, the whole issue of the perception of within particular societies like Kenya, which has been, affected by the problem of violent extremism.
Pundits say that many times exaggerated narratives and perceptions have been employed by national governments to justify punitive measures against entire communities, as Noor explains.
Looking at the responses that came out, does Islam, for example, promote terrorism, tells you that there's a problem, first of all, from the community level in terms of understanding each other. And I think even the issue of ethnicity, it's propagated because there's no national reconciliation. All these things are swept under the carpet sometime.
Sheikh Ibrahim Lithome, a Kenyan Islamic scholar, warned against widespread misuse of religious texts, which can be used by individuals as an excuse to commit violence.
He says everyone, including government, religious leaders, women groups, the society at large, as well as the media, should be involved in the debate. In Kenya, the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has carried out several assaults across the country in the past few years, including the deadly massacre in 2013 at the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi that left 67 people dead. In Cameroon, Boko Haram attacks have become the most visible sign of radicalization as the extremist group spreads violence from neighboring Nigeria. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In conjunction with the visit of Judith Heumann, the Special Advisor for International Disability Rights for the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa pledged financial support through the Ambassador's Special Self-Help Program, or SSHP, and the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, to five projects initiated by different Ethiopian organizations to work on disability and development issues. The five organizations are among the 20 new grantees who won the 2015 SSHP and PEPFAR Small Grants Award Competition from the 180 initial applicants. The grants are aimed to help the recipients to produce assistive devices, including crutches and walkers, promote inclusive public libraries equipped with Braille and computer software to enable visually impaired clients to use the computers, and provide HIV/AIDS awareness training, prevention, and support services for people with disabilities. The individual grants for these organizations range from $8,000 to $25,000. The $90,000 total award from the U.S. government will have a positive impact on over 1.7 million Ethiopians from Asosa, Awassa, Mekele, Jima, Arsi, Gondar, and Ambo provinces through various capacity building and livelihood interventions. Speaking at the signing ceremony, U.S. Ambassador Patricia Haslick said, "The Ambassador's Special Self-Help Program and PEPFAR's Small Grants reflect the United States government's commitment to inclusive economic development for Ethiopia's most marginalized communities, including people with disabilities. In Ethiopia, the SSHP and PEPFAR offer small-scale, short-term support for projects that intend to benefit the larger community and bring tangible improvements to people's lives. The United States is proud to work with its partners in Ethiopia to help meet the development needs of the Ethiopian people."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.